coming back home and taking a look at the JSE's performance. The All Share down 0.5% by the finish. As you can see there, weighed down by the Industrial 25, losing 1.4%. The Financial 15 trading 0.5% lower. The Resources 10 component, in the meantime, managing a 1.2% climb. Joining me in studio now for a closer look at the day's markets activity, Caroline Kremen from AdviceWorks. Thanks so much, Caroline, for joining us today. So it's pretty much a mixed bag when it comes to trading performance globally today. What are you making of the JSE's performance amidst it all?
Well, you know, contrary to the risk on trade everywhere else, emerging markets looking a little bit better, JSE went the other way. But that was really on the back, I think, of very specific earnings, notably ShopRite, which really surprised to the downside and dragged up a lot of those, dragged down a lot of those marginal retailers that, people have had worries about, Woolworths, Spar, for example.
Absolutely. And to bear in mind, ShopRite out with its trading update at about 5:30 yesterday afternoon. So today, the first real reaction to that news that filtered through yesterday. While we are on the retail scene, Lewis on the flip side reporting a 13.2% rise in third quarter revenue. What do we read into that number based on the fact that it's largely based on the acquisition of UFO?
So I think it's probably one of those consumer retailers that actually performed well. So it was a bit of a surprise for everybody. Look, the purchase of UFO was really there to grow Lewis's book, you know, because it's very much a low-income furniture provider. So UFO looking more to the middle market and upper market. And again, just coming to another set of results, you see even in the Spur results, that upper income bracket that seems to be relatively recession or slowdown proof at this point. I think it's quite an impressive set of results from Lewis. I think one thing that always has concerned me about the company is that, you know, about a quarter of their revenue still comes from the insurance, their financing. So it is still, and that's still going to be the lower end of the market.
Absolutely.
So very vulnerable to any further economic slump. Weakness.
I want to hone in on Spur before we leave it, because it was saying that first half restaurant sales ticked up 6.5%. And if we drill into the detail of what you were alluding to, it's Hussar Grill that really propped things up, right?
And Rocco Mama's.
Yeah.
And also the international side of things grew a little bit more than the local side. So, you know, clearly there is still money at that top end. I think also, you know, mustn't actually forget the fact that they still managed to grow the other, you know, the Spur restaurants, except for Panarottis, which is not doing so well, in excess of inflation. Mm-hmm. So in this type of market, with that type of demographic, you know, it's really all that you can hope for. So an okay set of results.
Absolutely. Well, overall, as you say, that retail space coming under pressure, ShopRite losing 14.2%, followed by Truworths, Woolworths, the Fushini Group, Spa Group. So the top, worst five performers on the top 40 index, all emanating from the retail space. So I want to take a look at the opposite end of the continuum, because miners trumping, and largely on the back of gold miners. We know they've been propped up by that gold price, which has found support, of course, as it stands as a hedge against looser monetary policy globally. Having said that, though, some very distressing comments coming through from the Minerals Council South Africa, saying that Eskom's tariff plans will in fact destroy mining, barring one gold company in South Africa. So how's the markets interpreting that?
Look, I think people don't really understand it that well. And I think sometimes when the CEOs speak like that, people think they're over-exaggerating. But if you think they're over-exaggerating, take, for example, Anglo Gold's financials, and then go and look at the cost per mine and the cost per mine for per ounce of gold mined. Look at it everywhere else in the world and look what it is in South Africa, because there's a massive difference. So a lot of these things are really, really borderline. And a decision needs to be made. You know, it seems to be a bit unfair, because we were always propping up the bulletins and things when they were here, Glencore, all of these things we were propping up, but there's an issue about jobs. So I think there's going to be hard decisions, you know, that are going to have to be made. You know, do we, the consumers, pay more and we still give business a break so that we keep jobs? I just don't know how they're going to resolve this.
Absolutely. Any speculation during the rounds as to who that one resilient gold company would be? Because the Minerals Council keeping pretty mum on that.
Yeah, I would anticipate it might be Goldfields or one of the Anglo, but it's difficult to tell.
Yeah, okay, difficult to tell at this stage. Eskom not only triggering woe for our miners, but EOH as well. We've had EOH come out and loudly rubbish misconduct allegations that have been leveled against it. Do you think that EOH is being unfairly punished at this stage?
I'm in two minds about that. You know, on the one hand, I do think where there was smoke, there was fire, and I think, you know, people are looking at Eskom now. I've looked at these things in a great amount of depth. On the other hand, I've got a lot of respect for the management that's there at the moment, Stephen Francola. You know, and for me, if he's a guy that comes out and says, look, this was done, dealt with, I'm inclined to believe him. So we'll see how that plays out in the weeks ahead.
But it's something you've got to wait to see play itself out. So in the interim, what's your stock pick?
Okay, it's not going to be one stock. It's going to be a group of stocks. So I think while the rand is relatively strong and the U.S. market looks fairly valued, if you don't have a direct offshore exposure in your portfolio, use the opportunity to buy some of the ETFs listed locally that focus on the U.S. market. Look at the Core Shares, the Glodiv, there's the Signia U.S. Just really start to bolster your U.S., your offshore exposure.
On that note, let's leave it there. Thanks so much, Caroline, for having joined us in studio this evening. Of course, Caroline Kremen is with AdviceWorks. Alexander Forbes Investments has identified key themes and global asset management trends that investors will have to explore when it comes to their future investment decisions. Janina Slorski, who's the principal investment consultant at Alexander Forbes Investments, joins us in studio now with more of the detail. Thanks so much for joining us, Janina. Right at the top, you say that passive will continue to win. Talk us through that, because one assumes that amidst all the uncertainty, investors would opt to be more active, especially, you know, as we ventured into uncharted territory on so many fronts.
Agreed. But if you have a look at the past 10 years, we've had extraordinary circumstances of very low interest rates, cheap money. So relatively unsophisticated investors could take that money and invest into stock markets and get fantastic returns. So we've had massive flows going into passive, driving up asset prices at very low volatility. So it's a massive trend that we've been seeing. And yes, things are changing. Now we're seeing interest rates going up. We're seeing volatility coming back into the market. So the next 10 years, yes, we would expect more and more active asset strategies to come to the fore. But the reality is passive will still be there. Investors don't like paying high fees and not getting the returns they expect out of active management. So we're expecting it to be still a trend, but to start becoming smarter. So people want to pay less, but they will want some sort of active overlay, which means it's smart meter and not pure passive.
Exactly. So we're not really looking at a pure passive play then at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, you definitely want to be pure passive when markets are going up. When markets are going down, as we've seen certainly in the last 12 months and in going into the future, you want some sort of active overlay, but investors don't necessarily want to have to pay full active fees.
Yeah, which speaks to another trend you've pointed to, and that is big data and technology changing, in fact, the way money is managed at the end of the day.
That's a massive challenge for asset managers. The ones who don't catch up with technology are going to get left behind. We talk about disruption, new players coming into the market, and they don't have the fetter of the existing systems, etc. And they appeal to people who actually want to invest directly and allocate and look online. And obviously there's also a trend towards actually using big data to manage portfolios. Mm-hmm. So artificial intelligence strategies that actually look at data and try and allocate on the basis of that and hopefully earn some alpha.
So amidst the shifts that we're seeing on those fronts then, to what extent are you anticipating these shifts to include more alternative investments in various baskets?
Significant trends. I mean, I almost call it the barbell strategy, where in your listed space, you're going towards passive. You want to pay the limited amount of expenses, which gives you a budget actually to look at the other side. Mm-hmm. And this is where active management plays a massive role. There's no way you can go passively into unlisted investments. These are your big investments into renewable energies and infrastructure, etc., where key managers who can actually add value will see assets growing.
Okay, so it's all a balancing act here, and when it comes to it, it's about trying to mitigate against investment risk that sits on the horizon, hedge your investments. Is enough significance being placed on risk management specifically, given some of the harsh lessons we've learned since, I guess, 2008?
Yes, definitely risk management is seen differently going forward. I think investors and other parts of financial services were very surprised about what happened in 2008. So we spent the last 10 years with asset managers becoming far more clever in terms of risk management, taking a lot more data in. It is another area where we see big data actually adding value to risk management systems. And actually understanding where you're going to get value as you allocate across passive, smart beta into alternatives. And we actually see investors demanding far more in terms of better risk management. Regulators are demanding more, and it's a way for asset managers to differentiate themselves if they can prove that their risk management is superior and they can use it to deliver enhanced risk-adjusted returns.
This, of course, as the chase is on for repeatable risk-adjusted returns. How high is sustainable investing ranking on investors' priorities right now?
It's growing and growing. To date, you can almost say that a lot of investors have done a tick box, but regulations changing and so are investor preferences. We've seen quite a shift, particularly on the retail side, towards younger investors who care passionately about their investment, the world, and they actually want to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And also the largest investors in the world, the sovereign wealth funds, the endowments and foundations, they're actually looking at impact investing and saying, not only are we going to do sort of negative, positive screening, not only are we going to look at ESG factors, we actually want to move into impact investing, where the money we spend actually changes the world for future generations.
Where that's the investment sentiment that we're looking at, are we actually seeing companies follow through and put very lucrative investment cases on the table that investors deem worth investing in?
Yes. And again, there's been a tick box attitude. You've had a lot of very detailed sustainability reports coming out, but you haven't really seen it coming through in practice. They just keep talking about that we're going to be cleaner with our dirty energy. Yeah. They're not fundamentally making changes. And obviously, as investor preferences change, they have to become more and more convincing. So yes, you will see companies that have convincing sustainability investing cases starting to see traction.
Are investors that circumspect about what they're actually buying into?
It'll range. So obviously, maybe your average retail investor in the end is actually just looking for something cheap and accessible. Mm. But they do want to also say, but give me some assurance that I'm at least investing, that you are voting my shares, etc. But definitely the higher up the chain, institutional investors, endowments, high net worth individuals, they're asking the hard questions, and okay, we are going to see a difference coming
through. As far as disruptors are concerned, you cite the fact that China will be a disruptor in international asset management. How so?
Two ways. First of all, China is starting to be accessible to more and more of the international investment market. They're opening up to allow investors to come and invest into their A shares. And this has led actually to the international index providers starting to include those shares. To date, they haven't. They've said they're not accessible, they're not investable, and therefore we'll exclude them. But from last year, MSCI has started to include. Other providers will be following this year. So essentially, investors have to look at the world and say, China is the second biggest economy. I've got less than 3% invested in it in my global equity portfolio. I need to make a change. So that's the one perspective. And then the other side is the actual investment management business.
Yeah.
That is projected to become the second largest in the world. So all of your big international asset management firms are saying, we have to get into China. Otherwise, we're going to be left behind. The people that succeed there will be the serious disruptors in terms of future.
Absolutely. Well, Yanina, let's leave it there. Thanks so much for having joined us in studio this evening. Of course, Yanina Slawski is with Alexander Forbes Investments. And while these trends emerge, of course, it's amidst a very complicated global environment. And in the global arena, of course, we've just seen British Prime Minister Theresa May looking at making some changes in her Brexit deal. We get more detail on that straight after the break, so stay with us. Well, Theresa May is set to reopen Brexit talks with Brussels. That's as the British Parliament backed a proposal for her to renegotiate the current deal. Let's head over to Bronwyn now for more insight on this developing story.
Thanks, Alicia. Well, we have just 58 days until the UK has to leave the European Union. And as the clock ticks down, Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May has been told by MPs that she has to go back to Brussels and reopen talks on a Brexit deal. It's an unenviable task that May is faced with. But the question now is, will the EU be open to negotiations, or does this seal the fate on a hard Brexit? To find out, let's cross to the trading floor at the Frankfurt Stock Exchange, where Paul Christian Brits is standing by. Paul, how likely is it that we're going to see that Brexit deal renegotiated?
How likely? Not at all. The EU has outright rejected the idea of going back and renegotiating this. It says it is not renegotiable. Across Europe, the voices have been the same, from Emmanuel Macron to Angela Merkel. There's no leeway, at least no leeway that can be perceived. So the UK is risking now falling into a hard Brexit, without even wanting that, because when Parliament did discuss various options, not only did they not find a majority for any possible other solution, they also decided the one thing that we can stand behind is we do not want a hard Brexit. What else they want, we do not know. Neither do businesses, and they're concerned. A lot of retailers are starting to become preppers. You know, these people who hoard stuff in their basements? That's exactly what supermarkets are doing. They are starting to stockpile food because they're worried that food supplies are going to be disturbed, supply chains are going to be disturbed. Sainsbury, Marks & Spencer, Co-op, they've all even written a letter to the government saying, you know, this is going to be trouble. Supply chains might be disturbed, and in the end, this is going to go onto the customers. They're going to pay a higher price for your political game.
So while that plays out in Europe, across the Atlantic, a Chinese delegation is arriving in Washington. That's to talk about the other big risk event that's top of mind for investors, that being the issue of global trade. What kind of strategy do you see the U.S. using going into those negotiations? And do you think the two countries are likely to come to an agreement at all here?
The likelihood of an agreement, I think we're going to see a very meager progress, if any, by the end of the week. We'll probably hear that talks are going very well and we're very close to a deal, probably in a tweet from Donald Trump, but we're not going to see much progress, at least that is not expected right now. And the problem really is that there is no, at least no apparent coherent strategy, because, you know, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin says the one thing, Robert Lighthizer, negotiators, the other, what Donald Trump wants is really nobody really knows. And there's so many issues on the table. There's intellectual property concerns. There is cybersecurity concerns with Huawei. The recent case just came up, and that's certainly not helping the mood.
Okay, so geopolitics aside, on the corporate news front, Apple's Tim Cook is optimistic about the company's prospects despite a slide in iPhone sales. How are you weighing up Cook's optimism against those disappointing numbers, Paul?
Well, first off, there is no outside of geopolitics, because Apple is right inside geopolitics here. The reason why iPhone sales have dropped and it's lost 15% of its revenue is because the iPhone is not performing in China. And so it is right within that conflict. Now, and that is, it is a problem. It is a problem for Apple. Tim Cook said he is very optimistic the two countries are going to get together and find a solution. Now, I'd be very curious where he got that information from. But the company is going to have to look for another strategy. Now, fortunately, there is some positive in the earnings that we saw, and that is in the service sector. The company actually makes 63% profit margin. 63% in the service sector. So that's Apple Music, the App Store, these kind of things, whereas the rest of the company is a 38% profit margin. So this is very, very promising. The problem is only that right now it only makes up a small amount of the company's revenue, whereas the iPhone still makes about 60%. So there needs to be a shift in strategy, a major shift. And the question is, can Tim Cook make this shift quickly enough, and will it actually help in that competitive market in China?
Paul, thanks so much for your time today. We've got to leave it there for now. Paul Christian Brits is from Deutsche Welle. Alicia, it's back to you.
Thanks, Bronwyn, and that's where I leave things with you for now. Stay tuned for ETF Investor coming up straight after the break, and I'll see you back at 7 o'clock. What's your stock pick?
Okay, it's not going to be one stock. It's going to be a group of stocks. So I think while the rand is relatively strong and the U.S. market looks fairly valued, if you don't have a direct offshore exposure in your portfolio, use the opportunity to buy some of the ETFs listed locally that focus on the U.S. market. Look at the Core Shares, the Glodiv, there's the Signia U.S. Just really start to bolster your U.S., your offshore exposure.
On that note, let's leave it there. Thanks so much, Caroline, for having joined us in studio this evening. Of course, Caroline Kremen is with AdviceWorks.